From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. It's our Monday politics as usual. As you were just hearing, Obama has two new cabinet appointees, former Senator Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense and counterterrorism expert John Brennan as possible head of the CIA. That's the position, of course, held earlier by David Petraeus. And then closer to home, the Boston City Council just voted on its next president. And two-term president Stephen Murphy was elected to a third term, except Mayor Menino may be eyeing him for Suffolk County Sheriff. We're going to be talking about that and more. Joining me here in the studio are Toby Berkovitz, former political consultant and an associate professor of advertising. What? All right. At Boston University. And Glenn Johnson, he's political editor for Boston.com. So, Glenn, I was really counting. I was sort of betting that Mayor Menino was going to appoint Steve Murphy interim sheriff today before this vote even took place, but it didn't happen.
Well, I mean, technically the appointment is through the governor. And it's my understanding that Andrea Cabral, whose ascendance to be the head of the public safety secretariat in the Patrick cabinet, is not interested in having Steve Murphy
because they
in
ran
that
against
post.
Each other. But it would have been very gracious of her to do that.
Sure. And so I think that, the word I heard was it was part of the package deal. She gets this job. He doesn't get that job. And so I think for Murphy, that's why you saw this interest from him in having one more year as council president. So we all remember that Tom Menino was one Vatican appointment away from heading out of the city council into some other job in Boston before Ray Flynn took an appointment from President Clinton. And Tom Menino went on to be the longest serving mayor in Boston history. So there is a reason for him to hang around, especially with the mayor's illnesses of late.
Exactly. Well, there was a lot of speculation that maybe it was the governor. I don't know why I said mayor. That the governor would appoint Steve Murphy and then Menino would have somebody that he wanted in as council president, like Rob Gonsalves or somebody. But, my bet is tell me what you think, Toby, that Menino is running again. I mean, I just don't see any way he won't.
Most likely. And you talk about a Rose Garden strategy. He can do a Parkman House strategy. he can do a Brigham and Women strategy. Yeah. Whatever he wants, he can do. And the other thing about Menino, frequently there'll be pressure on a politician. Make up your mind so that everyone can start planning, lining up what they're going to do. Menino will do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. Yep. And there really can't be any pressure on him. He's just going to be immune to it. So he's really in the driver's seat. And my guess is he will run because there's really, A, not any serious competition, and B, whatever he wants, he can do.
Absolutely. I had a couple of people here in the studio on Friday, Dave Wedge among them, who saw Mayor Menino the day before. And Dave said he looked fantastic. You know, he's lost about 40 pounds. I mean, he's still seated behind the desk.
Right.
He's not.
The photos are all
walking
in passenger seats of cars or sitting at desks and things like
He's not ambulatory, so to speak. But Dave said he looked great and all the puffiness was gone and that he felt good.
And it's not exactly like he's going to have to hit every street corner to run an aggressive campaign.
Right.
So, he can really do this how he wants and from whatever venues he wants, whether it's an SUV or behind a desk.
I agree with you. I think that's going to happen.
I just think the bigger issue for him is whether or not he gets incapacitated again. I mean, he was knocked out of the scene for a month there.
More than a month, really.
Descriptions of what was going on from his staff.
Everybody went along with that.
Yeah.
Including reporters to a certain extent.
And so if that comes at some point during the campaign, that's another issue. But, you see the popularity for him in every vote and just when he goes around the city. People like him.
They think
he's done a good job. He's been, a steady hand at the tiller through this whole time. And so unless something incapacitates him, he's going to be very hard to dislodge from that office.
What's going to happen with the State of the City address, which is week after next, I think.
Right. And it's always a big deal for him.
Yeah.
He takes note of who's there and who isn't.
And that's carried live by Channel 5. I mean, but is he going to be able to stand? How are they going to do that?
I don't know. I mean, you remember Donald Rumsfeld always doing his briefings sitting behind a podium. I guess it was Bob Gates at the Pentagon, and I could see something similar to that. Nothing. He just liked – he was, you know, former college president.
So just get a high stool.
Yeah. Well, he used to sit at a table and almost like a moderator at a debate, you know, would sit there and speak. And there's no reason that the mayor couldn't do that too. I think everybody's pretty well aware of you know, his lack of ambulatory ability right now. Mm. So
it would be off.
So the answer is wherever he wants, however he wants, whenever he wants,
and
just turn on your TV.
All right. Well, it's kind of funny how absolutely no one was willing to kick him while he was down. Not that they should, but I'm just saying everybody was just so terrified. You know, he was going to come roaring back, which he appears to have done. So nobody was like trying to push him aside or getting into the race. Nobody was jumping in. All right. A couple things happened late last week and over the weekend. Governor Deval Patrick nominated Mary Beth Heffernan as a judge. She was the ex-Office of Public Safety chief. But, you know, she basically was one of the people who handed in her resignation. But, I mean, you know, she's got a couple of those things hanging over her, including the drug lab thing and the compounding.
Yeah, well, the drug lab thing and the compounding center really affected more the public health. Dr. Judy Ann Bigby. The thing that was hanging over Mary Beth Heffernan's head was this Sheila Burgess issue, where you had this head of the Highway Safety Program who had a rap sheet longer than, you know, a lot of cars, and so there was a question about Heffernan recommending her for that job or interviewing her for that job. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to me to note that as the word came out last week that the governor was nominating her for this judgeship, there was a lot of support for her from the Republicans on this. Dan Winslow, who, you know, is not shy about his own gubernatorial aspirations out there, and is a lawyer, was a former counsel to Governor Romney, you know, went on to Twitter and said that she would be a great judge, that she had been great in the legal community. Dan Haley, who had been Carrie Healey's chief of staff and a counsel there and involved in her gubernatorial bid, said the same thing. And so you had people who, removed from this Burgess controversy, actually felt very strong things about her, felt that, you know, you're always going to have some kind of scandal whenever you're running a cabinet secretariat. But she had been a prosecutor. She had headed the District Attorneys Association, and she had been in the legal community, the daughter of a judge. And people felt that she had the right temperament and background for a judgeship.
It just doesn't look good.
The timing, definitely not. Yeah.
It's really business as usual as far as the public perceiving this type of appointment. It's patronage. I think a lot of people, if they pay any attention to this type of thing at all, and some of the papers are trying to drive it, sort of see it as, you know, sort of one hand scratching the other. And it's sort of typical. But the thing that Glenn pointed out, which is absolutely right, is really you can see a lot of support building for her. So my guess is that this is just going to go right through.
The thing that's interesting, too, is that the governor did it right away.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even let this passion
simmer.
Subside.
No. It's like a week and a
half. He just went at it. And I think, you know, there's two things at play there. One, he knows that lame duck status is not too far down the road, and so he's going to do these things. And two, I think, you know, some of this is just his personality. He's been in office now for 6 going on 7 years, and he feels like he's not afraid anymore to take such bold steps and challenge comers to him. You know, if you want to fight this, you want to debate this, as he did in the news conference on Friday, come on at it. And he went around and around with a reporter who challenged him on it and showed no fear of doing that. Very different from the way he was in 2007 when he first came into office.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, really the bottom line here is, what are you going to do about it when it comes to Beacon Hill? And who wants to spend the capital on this fight if that's where you're going to spend the capital, trying to fight with a very popular governor? Mm.
So what is your theories, Toby Berkovitz and Glenn Johnson, about Barney Frank? Did he call up the governor and say, listen, I would like to be interim senator when John Kerry gets confirmed to Secretary of State? And did the governor hesitate? I mean, what happened? Why is he out there kind of campaigning for this job now?
I think this is Barney being Barney. And all of a sudden, he's sitting in front of a camera and it's like, well, this seems like a good idea. And so I think he just feels that it's sort of either owed him or he owes it to the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I wouldn't read much into it in terms of any kind of deals. It's just sort of a Barney shocker, I guess, and sort of par for the course.
But doesn't that – isn't there the potential there, though, Glenn, to annoy the governor if he already had a conversation with him?
For sure.
Why? I mean, the governor likely said, well, let me get back to you, and I'm considering a couple other people. And then he goes out there and does a public campaign.
Right. Well, I talked to Barney after this started to come out on Friday morning, and I asked him what the governor's reaction was. And he said, well, as you can expect, he was noncommittal. And I know this for a fact. The governor wanted this to be a sober, deliberative process. He wanted to have these conversations, but he wanted to make this decision in due course. He also didn't want to announce anything about this until it was signed, sealed, and delivered that John Kerry was confirmed as the next Secretary of State. He didn't want to get out there, make a premature appointment, and then all of a sudden have Kerry blow up on the confirmation panel there. So he had his own steady Eddie approach to this thing, and then Barney just burst into the scene. And I'll take Barney right now at face value. He's on Morning Joe. He gets excited or asked a question, and he gives an answer very honestly about saying that he asked the governor for the job. The problem about that, though, is it put the governor in a very awkward position. You know, the governor has had other people ask him for the job, both for themselves and for other people.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden,
who doesn't want it?
You throw Barney's name out there, and everybody starts debating around the logic of it, which, if you remove Barney's personality from it, actually, there is a lot of logic for him to have that appointment.
There is.
But that's not the way the governor wanted to approach this. And so I think that partly explains, although they'll never admit it, why Doug Rubin, the governor's political advisor, top political advisor, went out on Saturday and said, I like Barney, but there's a lot of people who are better qualified for the job. Almost like a sanction hit, although Rubin denies it, on Barney after he put the governor in this very awkward position.
Which doesn't mean that the governor won't give it to him.
No, but I think it's a little brushback pitch. Mm. You know, you got to remember to respect our authority and our process here.
The other thing that's interesting in this is Elizabeth Warren, who is going to Washington with all sorts of spotlight, although she's been pretty calm about it, watching what she's done as the new senator. But who wants all the oxygen sucked out of the room, and Barney will absolutely suck every last bit of oxygen
out.
And
she's the senior senator.
She's the senior senator. But she also spoke very highly of him as her mentor for the campaign and all that. But, you know, I think what Barney's done is pretty much put everyone in an awkward position.
Yeah.
And some of them are sort of playing softer ball than others. And I think Elizabeth Warren, if you're going down there to start your role as the senior senator of the Commonwealth, which she will be soon, and then all of a sudden to have Barney come blasting into the room.
There could be a benefit to that too.
I definitely agree with you, Emily. I think that for her, it actually – if she's going to follow the Hillary Clinton model, she's going to want to be a backbencher, so to speak, anyway. And B, Barney actually does know what's going on around there and has a lot of relationships.
Much more than she does.
So he takes the pressure off of her.
Exactly.
Everybody was after Scott Brown saying, what do you think about the fiscal cliff deal? Where are you on this? You know, and he was always very uncomfortable in that position. Now everybody's going to be after Barney. Yeah. Barney's going to be out there on the floor. Barney would be in all the TV shows. And Elizabeth Warren would be able to go about this thing in her senior senator statesman.
Right.
But if Barney is going to be the bull in the china shop,
does
Elizabeth Warren sort of want to be the one following him around with a dustbin trying to clean up after him? That's my only point.
Yeah,
well, I don't know if she'll have to do that. So what did you make of Markey's attempt to kind of clear the Democratic field? I actually thought it was kind of a brilliant strategy.
Sure. I mean, that is what you would expect from somebody who's been in the House for 36 years. This is the way you do it. You come out there with this lightning strike, not just with John Kerry dancing this very fine dance about who he would endorse, and that is Ed Markey. But then you also ask Vicky Kennedy to come out and give her endorsement.
And the entire DNC.
Well, the one that is the most interesting, I think, out of all of those is the DSCC, which is the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, coming out and endorsing. And that is a committee that's charged with electing the Democrats to the Senate, is in charge of raising money for them. And the fact that before two other sitting congressmen had publicly announced their intentions. They announced their endorsement of one of another one, Ed Markey. It sends a signal to them, but also, you know, I think they view that as dirty pool, that they should be able to be treated as equals, that they should be given due deference to make their decision in their own course. And no, the DSCC said, we're behind Ed Markey. And you know, that kind of decision doesn't get made without Harry Reid signing on it, and probably the White House. So that is a very strong signal
to
Capuano and Steve Lynch.
And Ed Markey's part. I mean, he really worked that.
Right. So basically everyone is behind this except maybe the voters in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
Right. And I think if you're looking at, well, what could the weak link be? It's what kind of campaigner is Ed Markey going to be?
Yeah.
What kind of candidate? Now, obviously, he will put together a stellar team and he'll have all the pros working behind him. But, you know, is he as strong as everyone is making it out to be in terms of a broader electoral landscape in Massachusetts? So right now, you know, he's coming across the dean of the delegation and all that.
Right.
But can he get votes and can he be the kind of campaigner and run the kind of campaign against competition, whether it's other Democrats, which, of course, everyone is trying to avoid, or if there is a tough Republican opponent?
You know, he's the kind of guy who will stay on message because that's the way he does it. In fact, I don't know if you've interviewed him probably many times, Glenn, but I have to. Sometimes he'll start over, you know, in an interview, not live interview, but he'll say, let me redo that. So he's very, very studied and cautious. And he's a clever wordsmith.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he thinks about it in advance. But I think he's got a lot of broad appeal on that level because he's not an automaton.
Right.
I mean, he's not going to say the same thing every time, like the middle class is getting hammered. I think he has got a much broader appeal. And I think – you know, when people outside of our little region here get to know him, I mean, he's got expertise, you know, in such a broad range. In Western Massachusetts, the whole energy thing, you know, telecommunications. He's got so much in his background that I think people will warm to him.
Yeah, I think that the Brown people looked at him as somebody they wouldn't mind running against should Scott Brown get into this race. He's somebody that hasn't had a very competitive race in a long time.
You saw
this first little salvo, the questions about residency.
Mm-hmm.
There is, you know, vulnerability there. I look at sometimes at the comment line below stories I write, and when you get through the four-letter word ones, I know. A lot of people remarking, too, about his role in cable television rates. And you know that Scott Brown is very good if he runs at pushing those blue-collar, hot-button issues. And so there will be things there for an opponent to work at. And to Toby's point, to undercut any primary field and not really get those kinks worked out before you go to primetime here with a Republican opponent is a question mark. The thing, though, is if you're Ed Markey, you know, you have every right to do this. And you know what? He played his cards as best he could, and more power to him. You know, Lynch and Capuano thought they had time to really dot every I and cross every T, and all of a sudden everything was gone before they even had a chance to make up their mind.
Well, I think that does show that the brain trust working with the congressman is obviously very savvy, and they've done a very clear strategy how they want to do this. The only question would be, once you get into the campaign, are you in fighting trim? And, you know, can you sort of be a modern 21st century candidate if perhaps you haven't had to deal with that?
Yeah, it's tough. So, Glenn, here's my cynical mind at work. There was a letter to the editor over the weekend about Ed Markey's residency because there'd been – I mean, he said he'd been in the
did
state 30 –
Did you read
30,
that,
yes,
that letter?
Yes, I did. So – you know, here's the criticism. He came out in response to what Scott Brown said. Does he even live in the state? And the Markey people said, oh, he's been here 37 times. But he didn't say when, not in this year. It certainly wasn't in 1 year.
The equivalent of 34 round trips.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
Over the course of 18 terms.
Flyer
anyway,
miles.
So this letter writer goes on to say how often he sees him at his father's old home in Malden. Just last weekend, he talked to him on the porch. I did run into Markey just a few weeks ago downtown, so I know he has been around. But I almost thought that letter was a put-on.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'll just give you some examples of what I dealt with. Last week when this started with Scott Brown making his comment, I immediately asked the Markey campaign for comment, and it took like 7 hours to get it. And then when I got it, and it was this complete refutation of what Scott Brown had said, An hour later, or 45 minutes later, I get an unsolicited comment from the mayor of Malden talking about how this is ludicrous that Ed's not around here. I see him shooting hoops at the Y, and I see him at all of Malden's great restaurants on Saturday nights. And that, to me, again, is typical Markey, where, you know, he gets outsiders and third-party people to do this kind of endorsement. And then if you even read this letter editor, I'm not saying you, but just in general, if you really did a close reading of it, it wasn't really a complete endorsement of the fact that Ed is a regular person around there. It said, you know, I've seen him over time here. I wish I had the language in front of me. Because when I read it after reading, I was like, this isn't really
100%. Well, obviously he doesn't live there. I mean,
I mean, you know, the more expensive house that he owns, is
around
in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
I mean, like 500 yards from my twin sister in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Right.
I've walked over to his house a few times. So that's where he lives. And his wife is from the D.C. area, I believe. So, you know, they live in D.C.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is, will this residency issue, if it's an issue, hunt? And it might not. But could it be used to sort of pivot to a broader question of insider versus outsider?
Right.
And is it going to be an election where the voters in Massachusetts are mad at the insiders or not? And that frequently will sort of help to set up the playing field.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I hope he isn't slow to respond that way, because he's got to be ready. As you're right. I mean, his wheels could be a little rusty. He's not used to it.
Well, people say that they're like, oh, this campaign's just starting. Well, they're the ones that put a turbocharger on it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
All right. Talking to Glenn Johnson, political editor for Boston.com, and Toby Berkowitz from Boston University. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. We'll be right back. Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. We're talking politics, as usual, with Toby Berkowitz, Associate Professor of Advertising at Boston University, and Boston.com political editor Glenn Johnson. So, Toby, the fiscal cliff part two. We've got the tax part of this pretty much squared away. The GOP agreed to about $620 billion in tax revenues, which Nancy Pelosi has said is not nearly enough. Not nearly enough. I heard of that over the weekend. I thought, oh, my God, how much more? We're talking about taxes on individuals. So she says that's not enough. So the next couple of things that we're going to have to tackle is this, you know, raising the debt ceiling and the sequestering and all of that.
This is really a classic example of framing, and that is, how does each party position itself and try to get its message out to the public? And yet again, Obama has been much more successful framing this than the Republicans, because he's been saying it's taxing the rich, you know, that the rich have to pay their fair share. He's just going right back to the campaign that worked for him. And he's blessed with absolutely incompetent competition. You have poor Boehner walking around like he just should be carrying a pack of cigarettes in both hands, because he looks just so, you know, he's just hammered as badly from his own party as he is from the opposition. You have Mitch McConnell, who is not exactly Mr. Charisma. I mean, every time he goes on television, you know, your skin just starts to crawl. And so Obama really has absolutely the high ground. Now, whether that makes the most sense for America, whether these are actually the issues and the policies that America should follow to dig itself out of this fiscal mess, which, by the way, both parties are responsible for, is one question. But when it just comes to the pure politics of it, Obama has constantly trumped the Republicans. They can't get out of their own way, let alone out of the way of the Democrats. So it's a real mess. Now we're about to go into round two, and everybody just thinks back to Newt Gingrich and the Republicans strutting up and down the hills of the Congress, when and then all of a sudden having the government close down and then just absolutely being hammered because of that. You know, of course, many of these Republicans don't have that kind of memory, but any Republican who can
because those guys are all gone. That was the 1994 Congress.
Right. I mean, and so, you know, if it's the people who can think back to, gee, how did that turn out? And it turned out to be a disaster. So, you know, for a lot of the Republicans, they're thinking, yeah, close it all down and the public will be happy, whereas that was not at all how it turned out the last time this happened.
Well, according to CBS News, 68% of the United States does not want to raise the debt ceiling. But do they even know what that would mean, do you think?
I don't – you know, I agree with you. I mean, I actually thought something that was interesting as I was reading over the weekend. The Wall Street Journal had a pretty good analysis of the whole deal last week, and I had a couple charts. And while the president's stated position was that he wanted to protect the middle class and raise taxes on people making $400,000 and $450,000 and above – I was struck when you really look at the numbers, the way it's going to affect the average American. I mean, first of all, everybody gets hit with a 2% Social Security payroll tax increase. And those checks are going to start hitting everybody's direct deposit in the next couple of weeks.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah.
I don't get Social Security.
So that's everybody.
2%? That's
that.
A lot.
Yes.
And that's real
2%.
Money.
2%. And when you go from 4 to 6%, that's 50%.
So wait, when you get your Social Security check now –
This is not the check. It's the amount, the payroll tax,
taken out of
the
your
employer's
payroll.
The employee's payment into the Social Security Trust Fund, and then there was a bunch of other taxes.
Did they raise
taxes
that Social Security cutoff thing too? It was 110. Is it higher now?
Yeah, I think it went up to 140 or something like that.
Oh, so
but
it went up significantly.
When you look at the whole thing, you know, and when you look at. You know, yes, there was a benefit, but the taxes go up on capital gains, which isn't just the ultra rich. And, you know, there was a decent carve out for people owning family farms in terms of the estate tax and all that. But this isn't just something that whacks the very rich. The average everyday taxpayer does get hit by this deal. And to Toby's point, if the Republicans were a little more effective in messaging this thing, they could point out that, okay, you might want to be with us on this whole spending cut part of this because this is what happened on the tax side. Now we need to get some of this back in the programmatic spending side. And so far, they haven't really been able to get the president on this. But when you look at the numbers, it's not all roses for everybody that is in the group that the president said he was trying to protect.
Yeah, people are going to notice that.
And in fact, Obama and Pelosi and Reid have made it pretty clear the last thing they want are real cuts. And so if you're going to try to even come close to balancing the budget, which no one's going to do. I mean, really, what all of this is doing is just kicking the can over the cliff. And no one is really trying to solve this one way or the other. So it's really a political battle, almost more than an economic battle. It's, you know, what vision of government, what vision of the role that people should play when it comes to taxes and spending. And what you find is people want cuts in spending, but nothing that affects them. I mean, no one is willing to take any pain on this whole thing, and no one is really seriously addressing the problems when it comes to revenue and the problems when it comes to actually cutting. And I mean, if the Republicans were smart, they'd just say to the president, okay, let's see your cuts and the Democratic Senate's cuts. And
well, haven't they done that?
Well, the Senate hasn't even come up with a budget since when, you know, just in terms of just passing the buck, as it were.
As it were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything is still on the table. Entitlements, defense, everything.
Yeah, really, nothing was solved. What you keep doing
it'll
is
get solved when Barney Frank gets there.
Yeah, well,
to solve it.
Yeah, I mean, it's always what's the smallest Band-Aid we can put on a gaping wound, and that's basically what everybody does. Because again, the public says it wants certain things, but no one is willing to sacrifice. And then you get to the questions of, well, should the rich be sacrificing exponentially more than the poor, the middle class? And Glenn's point is exactly right. I mean, no one really cares and takes care of the middle class. It's all lip service about that. And basically, the Republicans sort of work for one constituency and the Democrats more or less for another. And then sort of the great public in the middle just sort of get hammered constantly.
Why was the same leadership reelected?
Why not?
For all the reasons you just said.
Well, you know, when you when
Boehner really took a hammer in.
Well, when you're looking at the House, it's the same thing. Who actually has the guts to stand up to the Speaker? Mm-hmm. Because if you can dethrone him, fine. But if not, you know, it's like how far in the basement do you want your office to be in the House of Representatives? So I think you know it's the same thing that happens on Beacon Hill, only played out much larger. Plus, who you know you need to coalesce around a challenger, and the whole problem is the House is so fractured on the Republican side. How are you going to coalesce around anyone, or you're just going to have all these you know little sections all sort of dividing everything up?
I agree. I mean, I think that the issue for John Boehner and the reason that he ended up being reelected as Speaker was because the people who have been challenging him were sent some sort of message in the November election, specifically the Tea Party Republicans. And yet you see somebody like Eric Cantor, who has been their spiritual leader, not really wanting to seize the reins of leadership. He is much better when he is on the outside in the number two position, pointing out what John Boehner is doing wrong, than he is being the guy with a nice office but all the responsibility to solve everything. Boehner has tried over time to try and herd these cats into different directions, and he's seen what's happened with that. And so for better or worse, he is the one person that can – unify mainstream Republicans with this more radical right-wing element and try and at least make some forward progress. And so that's why you haven't seen any change over there. On the Democratic side, you know, I think the Democrats think Harry Reid does an effective job mm-hmm. as Senate Majority Leader, and Nancy Pelosi, who's going to knock her out? I mean, she's the most prolific fundraiser in that chamber right now. And so, you know, the Senate Republicans seem plenty satisfied with Mitch McConnell too.
Well, and the great thing for the Democrats is the Republican leadership is so unpopular that even though Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi tend to get low ratings when it comes to public opinion polls compared to the Republicans, not so bad.
Talking to Glenn Johnson from Boston.com and Toby Berkovitz from Boston University. So the whole gun control thing, Biden has had several meetings. It's going to be interesting to me to see if actually there is any kind of legislation. I mean, I was listening to some of the talk shows over the weekend, and the swing on either side, it's just like, you know, you've got people saying, you know, everybody should be able to own an assault weapon if they want one versus other people saying, you know, we don't need them. You know, I'm a hunter. I don't need to have an assault weapon. But I don't think there's going to be a resolution to this.
It's going to be a tough one. I mean, people are voting already with their gun purchases.
Yeah.
When you look at the FBI background check numbers for December, which was, you know, halfway over before Sandy Hook even happened, and you see the volume increase in the number of people who went for guns in that period, and then you see even around here the local sales, you know, people are making it clear that they don't want their right to have and bear an arm infringed upon
at any cost. I mean,
I think the president still has the opportunity to sway public opinion, where you get to something like 30 magazine clips and mm-hmm. things like that, 30 round magazines, excuse me. And you know, there will be some debate over assault weapons, but you know, those are sold out now for a year in a lot of gun stores. Everybody snatched up everything they could, and so. You know, making any sort of real serious change in the gun laws outside of what the governor may try and do here in Massachusetts, which already has pretty strict gun laws, and so did Connecticut, you know, is going to be a tough sell.
Well, you look at what are polarizing issues, and this has really pivoted up to the top because a lot of the other social issues seem to have sort of settled somewhat. Things such as gay marriage, you know,
partial birth abortion.
Certain parts of the country have just sort of checked out in terms of this as a hot button. So all of a sudden, guns now for the right and the left have become this hot button issue again. And so I think what you're looking at also when you try to get this kind of legislation through in Washington, you have these sort of purple state Dems, senators like the new senator from – I forget if it's North or South Dakota who's a little hesitant. You've got the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin. A lot of these senators and certain House members, you know, are from sort of moderate mm-hmm. states.
Right.
They've managed to get elected because they position the Republican as a right-wing nut, and they managed to then get elected. But they have to tread very gingerly when it comes to this. And so, of course, it seems very like common sense to ban certain types of assault weapons and magazines and things like that. But sometimes how it's going to play back home can be a real issue for really in some ways for some of these moderate Democrats as much as for the Republicans.
I think that the more likely thing that you're going to see happen out of all of this is that there's going to be changes in access to weapons. Maybe not the availability of certain weapons in and of themselves, but you know, a much closer coordination over you know mental health records mm-hmm. and gun license applications. Maybe gun show access, you know, buying gun show weapons at gun shows, things like that, where they can move on the margin as to who gets their hands on guns, but not necessarily you know, take the guns that are already out in circulation
thinking,
you know, away from people.
How would that have changed? In for instance, just starting with the Newtown,
the kid took
his mummy's guns. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the ultimate challenge in all of this. I mean, is that you can change every one of these laws and you can make them as tight as you want, and then somebody can you know do a one-off type of thing, or they can go on to the next thing. You know, walk it into a mall with whatever kind of mass casualty device and doing it there.
Yeah, do it.
You know, and so it is. You're always chasing something, but on this subject, and as the president said after this shooting, you know, are you just going to basically throw up your hands and say we're not going to do anything else? You know, I think that's where you see mm-hmm. the people in Congress coalescing around the agreement that, you know, that you just can't say it's futile, we're not going to do anything. And so the most palatable way to try and do something without – you know, running into harsh opposition is to try and control access to weapons by people who really shouldn't have them.
But looking at Capitol Hill, you also have competing big issues that are sort of going to be trying to come to the forefront. So certainly now we've been talking about all the economic issues. You've got immigration, which is going to come back. And so the question for Obama and the Democrats is what capital and what precedents do we want to put for guns versus all these other issues that we're going to have to be dealing with? Can we send them all through at the same time? Where do we want to actually use our muscle? So I think that's going to also be a big question.
I hate to say it. It's almost like there needs to be another incident after this one because, I mean, the horror was the one after the Aurora one,
remember?
Well, no, there was a shooting mall one in Oregon that only got two or three people.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the shocking thing, you know, nobody had ever heard of Aurora, California before last summer. Now this thing over the weekend, I don't even know, was that an assault? Colorado, I don't know what kind of weapon. That would not have made the news if it were not the fact that it was Aurora.
Yeah, Colorado.
It would not have made the news.
Well, and then
it was only four people.
And we also have all the killings in the inner cities. You look at a city like Chicago, Detroit, mm-hmm. You know, and so yeah. When does the public start to again get aggravated about those
Almost
types of
things? Almost 500 people in Chicago last year.
It was over.
Makes our number, 58, seem pretty paltry.
Yep.
What's their population? Ours is 600. What is theirs?
They're larger.
Oh, yeah. They're at least three times as large, maybe more. But still, they got a bigger problem than we do. Yeah. So what's David Linsky here, and he's the Democrat from Natick. He's filing legislation that was going to cover kinds of guns here in Massachusetts. Again, you know, the ammunition eligibility approach. But we already, as you just said, Glenn, we've already got pretty stern gun laws here. What's he going to do there? That's going to make a difference. He hasn't released his details yet.
Yeah, but I think people will always file legislation. What happens, you know, with that is another question. And again, I think this is where you know, just listening to the governor talk on this, you know, if you already have strict gun restrictions in a state, you know, that's not really going to, you know, ratcheting them up is not really going to change anything. But if you can move into better coordination of you know, the accuracy or thoroughness of checks as to who can get access to these weapons, I think that's more where you're going to see the ultimate resolution from lawmakers both in Beacon Hill and in Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and it's Massachusetts, which tends to be on the forefront of a lot of these social issues. And so if these types of regulations are going to come from anywhere, it's probably a place like Massachusetts.
But, I mean, I always think, you know, people go to New Hampshire and they buy their guns. It's like we put all these little rules in place here in Massachusetts, and then somebody has to drive 40 miles to get what they
right.
want.
Well, and the real bottom line is Massachusetts, like everywhere else, is armed to the teeth. And so, you know, that's no matter if you could stop selling guns now, and there are so many guns floating around that could all change.
300 million.
Going to Glenn's point about gun shows, it sounds like a rational and smart way to move, but you've got a huge lobby there in terms of people, both in terms who like to go to gun shows and buy their guns, people who sell them, not even mentioning the NRA. So what seems like an easy place, or at least a place to start, everything then starts getting very complicated and difficult.
Well, I mean, my bet is that essentially nothing is going to happen there. I don't know. Anyway, moving along, a couple of big nominations this morning. Chuck Hagel, Secretary of Defense, John Brennan for CIA. I can't remember that much about Chuck Hagel. I was sort of like cramming my head full of stuff this morning.
It seems odd to pick a big fight over this. I guess, you know, it's a president that wants to have a Republican in his cabinet.
But the Republicans don't like him.
No, that's why he wants him.
I got that from Cokie Roberts.
You know, he's a veteran. And so, you know, there's two reasons to want him. But, boy, there has to be some other people out there.
Name was kicked around for Secretary of State as well.
Yeah, I don't think in any serious way, but yeah, he definitely was in that whole mix.
What does Chuck Hagel do right now? He's not a senator anymore.
No, he was. I think he's involved. I thought he was involved in a university and also in business.
Well, I mean, and also Hagel is typical of sort of the maverick politician, that everybody likes a maverick unless he's in your party. And that's basically what's happened with the Republicans. Plus, he really aggravated them because he endorsed Bob Kerry in the Senate race out there. So it's, you know, he's really persona non grata for a lot of this, which is ironic because the Senate tends to like to be very deferential to their own. And, you know, they really try to do everything they can to have that sort of senatorial courtesy. But I think he's pretty well worn out his welcome.
But would the Republicans dare not confirm him?
My guess is that there'll be a few, but the fact is in the Senate, there's not too much of a choice one way or the other. So you'll probably get a few people who sort of want to make a case for the hardcore Republicans. But if you look at Hagel's background, I mean, he's quite a character in terms of he's managed to make pretty much everybody mad. If that's what you want for your Secretary of Defense, which to me is kind of questionable, then he's your perfect candidate.
All right. So John Brennan, he, of course, worked with the president to plan the 2011 Bin Laden raid. I saw that movie last night, by the way. Zero Dark
really?
30.
Did you like it?
It was great.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this is off the subject, but well, not totally, but just recreating the entire thing, recreating that compound.
Yeah.
In Pakistan, recreating all the steps and the helicopters, and it was pretty.
The first
amazing
trailer I saw for it, I said, I know I want to see this, but I don't ever really read reviews, even
though
we
either have
these Pulitzer Prize winning guys at the Globe, because I just think that too often it gives away key
elements. I agree.
Elements
I didn't
the
read the reviews either.
But this one,
well, we know how this one ends.
Yeah,
though,
we
folks
do know how this one ends, and I think that the things that I've heard that make it so compelling is that Catherine Bigelow, like James Cameron with Titanic, took a story where everybody knew what happened, and still made it compelling.
Intense. It's like Argo, the same thing. You know what happened, but I mean, you're on the edge of your seat in the raid scene at the end.
Yeah.
The movie's long. It's like 2.5 hours. I always complain
about
everything's too long for me.
I think the thing that's interesting about all of these appointments in a way is that it shows in the second term the outreach of the White House into these different agencies and cabinet agencies. Not that the president didn't have control over what Hillary Clinton was doing, but with John Kerry at Secretary of State, you've got a guy that served with the vice president on the Foreign Relations Committee. But the president is going to have more control over John Kerry than he did, you know, this rival from the 2008 campaign.
That's a good point.
Part of the reason for putting Hillary in that role was she was her own independent thinker, and he was paying homage to what she brought to the table in the 2008 campaign. Now you have Robert Gates, who was a holdover from the Bush administration, gone from Secretary of Defense. You have Leon Panetta, who was a good soldier, moving over from CIA to SecDef, who's going to be departing. And you have Chuck Hagel, who owes his resurgence in Washington power circles to the president over at the Defense Department.
Yeah, he's
so
on
you
his
have
intelligence
the White House with a little
board,
more control over there. And then the final piece of this national security puzzle is you have John Brennan leaving the White House, where he's national security advisor, and going over to Langley to head the CIA. So the president has much more direct control over these agencies that he didn't really even know much about when he walked in 4 years ago on January 20th.
Well, also, Brennan's a good appointment because he comes from the CIA.
Right.
And the CIA always likes to have one of their own. Now, apparently, his philosophy is somewhat different in that he prefers sort of the long-term traditional looking at analysis over sort of the military muscle part of the CIA.
Right.
But still, at least they're getting one of their own back there. And that always tends to keep things smoother. It also tends to reduce the amount of leaks that come out in these sorts of situations.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that the movie really pointed out, and I think intellectually I had already thought about this, was how putting all these teams of intelligence and the incredible technology that we have to help us out, it's still a war against these individuals that are – it's not like an organized army or – and just the hunkering down and they call it tradecraft and the way they confuse the situation. There's a lot of driving in circles and you know that's real, all that kind of stuff that Al-Qaeda or whoever, in this case Al-Qaeda, but all those guys do in order to put intelligence off.
Well, and going to a broader picture, you have all the questions about the drone strikes where
first you need
people on the ground to set up the target, which is, by the way, kind of interesting because Obama has gotten beaten up by the left because of the drone strikes.
Yep.
But it's sort of the same type of thing. You need the intelligence first, then you can bring either your muscle or your technology to bear.
And how hard it is getting that intelligence. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of scenes in there where the great frustration from the head of the CIA and others saying, we've been at this for 8 years and we've got to show for it.
I think the futility of it always in these movies too. I mean, if you watched Restrepo, which was a great documentary made by Tim Hetherington before he was killed. I remember one scene vividly from that where the soldiers are up in the Afghan mountains and they're talking to, tribal leaders and they pass around juice boxes and people don't know how to put straws in juice boxes. Now, I understand that these people have never seen a juice box before, but if something that we take, it's just the cultural difference and
those open markets and
all that is just like if you're sitting there saying, I'm going to impose this point of view on somebody with this perspective, it just illustrates the challenge that you face and the ability to get bin Laden, I think, over all those types of hurdles was actually quite an achievement.
Yeah. I mean, I won't ruin it, but, right even at the end, I didn't know about this, but I mean, as the thing is taking place, as the whole episode is coming down, the neighborhood comes alive, and that became a very dangerous situation. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that if I ever knew.
A few years ago, I think it was Discovery Channel did some very good reenactment documentaries, and the CIA and the Defense Department were a little upset because of the amount of specifics that showed. I mean, obviously not with the art that's done in this type of movie, but there had been other stories that had come out that had sort of portrayed how this had happened.
Also, the waterboarding scenes, I mean, it was fairly commonplace at all those prisons. And, it's interwoven with some stuff from Obama saying, it's explicitly that we don't torture. But then, these guys are looking at each other in a room going, well, what is this? It's like,
it's enhanced interrogation.
Enhanced interrogation.
Yeah. So, there's your framing.
Anyway, I recommend it if you've got the patience. It's a bit long. And they could have speeded up the part, but like I say, I always complain about the length of things. All right. We have been talking politics as usual. Thank you very much to Toby Berkowitz from Boston University and Boston.com political editor Glenn Johnson. Thanks for being here. And Edgar B. Herwick III is back from the sublime to the ridiculous, which is much better.
How you doing, Emily?
Good.
So you're a big Pats fan.
I am, actually.
Did you watch football this weekend anyway, even though they weren't playing?
I did. I was, because my sister and family is a big Washington fan.
Okay.
So that didn't – I thought that was going to turn out, but it didn't.
I know it didn't. But and football's actually not the big story. Ugh. If there's anything that can push football off the front pages, it's the NHL coming back. And I know you care about zero.
It has not pushed them off the front page.
It's a big story anyway. NHL back. Football playoffs. We're going to do a little bit of a sports round. Up. Stick around whether you are a sports fan or not. We've got something for you.
All right, I'm Emily Rooney.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio. Please remove the parquet floor. Bring on the